Right. Welcome, everybody. I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 5:49 p.m. on Wednesday, March 10th, 2021. Members present are Representatives Kaufman, Schrage, McCarty, Nelson. On the phone, on Teams, we've got Representative Snyder, Co-Chair Fields, and myself. Thanks for our Secretary today, Leah Fraser, and our LIO moderator, Carson Walters. For staffing us all, to our IT staff, Derek Lale, which is a new member of the team to make sure that our Microsoft Teams run smoothly for everybody. We're holding today's meeting in a combination of in-person and remote participation. We're going to continue to do that. Members can join us over teleconference or Microsoft Teams. You can always send me a message if you want to ask a question. I'll also pause periodically to make sure that folks that are calling in or participating via Teams have an opportunity to ask questions. Please announce yourself before speaking so that those listening online know who is speaking. It also makes it easier for our House Record staff to take good notes about who spoke. I'm going to ask members to hold their questions. Once we get to the bill presentations, I'm going to ask folks to hold their questions until after the presentation takes place, and then members on Teams or on the telephone should mute themselves to ensure good audio quality. If you haven't now already, now is a good time to silence your cell phones. Cell phones that go off during the committee will obligate the member to bring donuts from the Breeze Inn to the next meeting. And I'm very, the co-chair is very specific about Breeze Inn. It's a high quality local donuts here in Juneau. Before we begin our meeting today, I want to provide a little bit of clarification on this committee's COVID policy, since there's been some changes lately. The committee co-chairs are committed to ensuring a safe workplace for our members, our committee aides, and the nonpartisan legislative staff that support us. So members are free to attend meetings in person or via distance if you're in the building. When we take official action, we will, if people are not in the room, we will take an at ease so that everybody in the building can come down and we'll go back on the record, take the official action, and sign the committee paperwork. So there will be in the room, we're going to allow co-chair staff, one minority staff member, and one member of the media in the room in addition to our nonpartisan LIO staff. We want to make sure that we're, you know, applying these rules sort of evenly and consistently so that everybody feels welcome and has access, you know, equal access to the committee. It's really important. Everybody else can participate via Teams or via telephonically. Members in the room need to wear masks, which we're all doing, that are compliant, that cover your nose and your mouth at all times, just so we're being clear and consistent. Legislators presenting bills in 1A may join either in person or via Teams as well. Whatever your preference is fine. We want everybody to feel comfortable, and then we just encourage everybody to get their vaccines as soon as possible so we can be safe and healthy and keep the legislature open for business. So we'll let folks on the committee know if there's changes to this policy, and feel free to reach out to us or our aides, Megan Holland or Grace Cubitz, if you have any questions. Did you have a question, Rep. Nelson?
Yeah, I believe, and tell me if this is wrong, that we previously agreed if someone's going to be on Teams, it was going to be a camera and microphone open. Just want to see if that's still the case or...
I don't think we actually had a discussion about that specifically. I don't remember that
being
specific.
Well, leadership, we're talking about that.
Okay, yeah, I actually have asked if people are online, telephonically, or via Teams, that they have their audio off, just so that we don't have any, noise, confusing the audio along the way. Mm-hmm. And I think that Rep. Snyder might have been eating her dinner, which is why the camera was off, and she is in her office. So, yeah. So first up today is a discussion about workplace safety in the seafood industry. Online for questions, we have Joel Knowles, who's the Director of Labor Standards and Safety, John Stallone and Dennis Smythe, who are both former ACOSH Chiefs of Enforcement. And then second, we're going to have an introductory hearing for Senate Bill 24, which relates to virtual meetings for corporations. And then later, we'll forward the appointees we considered at our last meeting to the joint session for confirmation. So at the end, we'll go after we gavel out stay to sign the paperwork for that. Are there any questions from members before we begin? All right. So our first item of business today is worker safety in the seafood industry. We're discussing this issue today in light of Commissioner Ledbetter's recent decision to waive a pretty significant $450,000 fine against Copper River Seafoods as recommended by ACOSH staff. We have a full agenda day, and we will likely have the opportunity to hear more about this moving forward. It's my intention to make sure that every member has an opportunity to ask two questions each before we move on to the next person. We give everybody a chance to ask questions, and if we have time for another round, then everybody can get another question, and we'll keep moving through until we make sure we get through our questions today. During this pandemic, the seafood industry has faced some really unique challenges in workplace safety. Unfortunately, it's experienced multiple outbreaks of hundreds of cases over the last few months, and the importance of this hearing to establish what the process for enforcing workplace safety in Alaska, to determine what the consequences, if any, are to the state if we don't comply in this process, and to discuss a waiver of the fine against Copper River Seafoods. Before we begin, I want to just let everybody know that we invited Commissioner Ledbetter to attend this meeting. We were told she wasn't available to attend today, but we look forward to having her at a future meeting. The intent of this meeting isn't to punish anybody, to just have a clear sense of what the workplace issues are that need to be addressed in Alaska, what happened here, and to understand the risks if we're not doing good workplace safety in Alaska. We also invited Copper River Seafoods to join us. There's a letter in your packet from Jonna Lindemuth, an attorney who represents Copper River Seafoods, about the issue. They did decline invitation on advice of their counsel to join us here today, but the invitation stands. We're happy to talk with them at any time. So after I introduce our invited testifier, I already referenced the couple of questions at a time. We just want to make sure that we have time for Senate Bill 24 introduction, as Senator Wilson is staying late today to introduce his bill. So first up, we've got Joe Knowles, the Director of Labor Standards and Safety Division with the Department of Labor. Mr. Knowles, are you online?
Yes.
All right, excellent. I want to ask you to introduce yourself. Could you start by talking about sort of when you came to the department, your history with the department, and the role of your organization?
I am Joseph Knowles, and I am the Director of Labor Standards and Safety. I came to the Department of Labor and Workforce and Development in January of 2015, if I recall correctly, and I started with Labor Standards and Safety in August of 2019.
All right, great. Thank you very much. All right, you want to describe your the specific issue at hand with regard to the workplace safety issue at Copper River Seafoods?
I was under the impression that I was here to answer any questions that folks may have of me today.
All right. Anybody have any questions for Mr. Knowles?
I have
a question. All right, Co-Chair Fields.
First, I want to acknowledge that Mr. Knowles and I used to be co-workers, and Mr. Knowles, nice to be with you here today, and thanks for your long service to the state of Alaska.
Yes, sir, thank you.
I think just starting out generally, at a hearing this summer, the Department of Labor, and I think you might have been presenting on behalf of the Department of Labor, you told the State Affairs Committee that the Department of Labor could use the General Duty Clause to protect workplace safety in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you just outline for members what the General Duty Clause is?
Yes, Representative. The General Duty Clause is an OSHA General Duty that requires employers to provide a work environment that's free of recognized hazards that are causing or likely to cause death or serious physical harm.
Great.
They are often used when there's no standard that applies to a particular hazard or in a situation where a recognized hazard is not covered by an existing standard.
Right. So during the time that you and department leadership were telling legislators that you could use the General Duty Clause for COVID-related enforcement, the State Department of Labor's ACOSH staff were investigating some potentially serious COVID workplace safety issues and conducting extensive research and on-site investigations before preparing a citation based on a willful violation of the General Duty Clause. And could you just explain to committee members. What does willful mean in the context of the laws that your division enforces?
Yes, Representative. Willful is where an employer has demonstrated either an intentional disregard for the requirements of occupational safety and health laws or a plain indifference for employee safety and health.
Can I ask just one more question before going to others?
I'm going to try to stick to our two in a row for a little while here, Rep. Fields. All right, are there any other questions for Mr. Knowles? Does everybody have a chance to review also the documents that were distributed? Representative McCarty?
I just got this packet here just before coming down, so I haven't had a chance to review this. I did have a chance to chat with one of our members in the committee just for about 20 minutes about this. That's all I know.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure people had it. Are there any other questions from members of the committee? Otherwise, I'll go back to Rep. Fields. Representative Snyder, any questions?
Not just yet.
All right. Is that Rep. Kaufman?
Thank you. Yeah, through the chair. One of the things I'm curious about, and I've been reading this, is the timing of all this. It seems like the inspection was done, but the report was not being processed until much later in the year. And I'm just curious if you can explain what may have been going on with that report.
Yes, through the chair. Representative, I don't have the full case file with me at this particular time, but I do recall that in last August that we did perform an inspection on this employer and that we did propose a citation and presented it to the commissioner for her approval on or about 27 December, and that during her review we became aware that the initial information provided in that proposal to her was largely incomplete. And then on or about 12 January, we confirmed that we had made a procedural mistake at the division level by not originally presenting the commissioner with the significant portion of that 7 August inspection for consideration. And then I believe her memo of 18 January was issued of her decision for this proposal, which was well within her range of legal options and authority.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair, yeah, that I've worked as an auditor and done inspections of facilities and assessments, and it strikes me as curious, to say the least. When I found important things, I was running that dog up to top leadership quickly, because for one thing, it's important, and the other, it's nice to be able to bring a big finding and explain it to management. It lets them know you're doing your job. So I don't know if I have a question, but just say this really puzzles me, the timing of such a finding and the delay in bringing it forward to process it. Thank you.
Mr. Knowles?
Yes. Through the chair, I appreciate your observation, and I can assure you that we learned a lot during this particular inspection package, and that we have already begun to take steps to improve our processes moving forward with those lessons learned. Thank you.
Representative McCarty.
So through the chair, you made mention that the packet originally was not complete, and that then later on that it was whatever was needed was presented so it was more complete, so that the commissioner can make a decision. Who brought the awareness in the beginning part that the packet wasn't complete? Was it the commissioner? Was it somebody that was inspecting? How did that become known that it wasn't complete in the evaluation?
Through the chair, yes, Representative, it became apparent in our discussions with the commissioner over their proposal that information within our initial package was in conflict and the information was not adding up. And as such, we went back within the labor standards and safety level and began to look at what information we had sent and and that is when we realized that we did not initially include the second additional related concurrent inspection requirements per our own internal field operations manual. So that was when we provided the rest of the information to make the package more understandable for her consideration.
Paula?
So, through the chair, so you're saying that you had to go back and see the protocol that was or was not followed to put together what was needed for the commissioner? And did that involve going back to the company where you did the audit to do further follow-up there?
Through the chair, representative, we did not need to go back through the company. What had happened on 7 August was two concurrent related inspections, and through a misinterpretation of our own field manual, we only sent up the portion or the inspection that pertained to the willful general duty proposal, when in fact we should have, because they were concurrent related inspections, included both proposals at one time.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Snyder, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Through the chair. Just trying to follow the timeline. How many levels of review did the proposed citations go through before ultimately being blocked by the commissioner?
Through the chair, again, I don't have that particular full case file in front of me with all the notes, but this was such a unique, significant inspection. This was my particular first effort to do a general duty willful. And so there was a lot of questions within the labor standards and safety between myself and the chief of enforcement, which again resulted in us sending the package forward to her incorrectly on the 27th of December, and when we were still in our communications and discussions within the department, realized that we had not included all of the information to allow her to be completely informed at that point in the process.
To follow?
Okay, thank you. No? Not yet. Thank you.
All right. Anybody who hasn't asked a question yet want to ask? Representative Shaggy?
Sure. Thank you. And through the chair. So you might not have all the details in front of you, but can you tell me generally how many levels of review are? Is there at least one level of review between this being generated and going to the commissioner that this was not? Was there no review in that transmittal to the commissioner that was really the first kind of quality control check on the process?
Through the chair. Yes, Representative, I'm sorry, I was not clear in my previous conversation. There is the initial level of review by the chief of enforcement himself, and then based on the nature of the proposal, it requires us to consult with, at the time, with the commissioner, and so I was involved with levels of review as well, and those levels of review at the enforcement level and at my level were focused solely on the willful duty proposal because of our misinterpretation of our policies and procedures.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Representative Nelson, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering specifically, through the chair, I'm just wondering specifically, how many of these investigations in that time frame did you do specifically relating to COVID? I just want to get a clear answer on that.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, could you be more specific on the time frame you're referring to?
Let's just say that 3-month period between, kind of right during that summer time period when COVID started to level out.
I don't have, again, through the chair, I apologize, I don't have all of our citations and the dates that they were issued, but I'm very confident that we had two inspections in that time frame within the seafood industry.
Follow on.
Follow.
Right, and are those given by referral, or are those given someone sends out a tip line? How do all businesses get inspected? Kind of how does that operate?
Through the chair. Yes, it is a typical ACOSH enforcement process or event would begin when we receive a complaint or a referral.
Follow on through the chair.
I'll give you one more.
Okay, my apology. I know you're two rule. I don't want to break it.
I'm trying to be consistent, Rep. Nelson.
Cost you a donut.
You said there was two other seafood related industries that were getting inspected around that time. So there was only three inspections of businesses during roughly that period.
Through the chair, the two that I'm talking about, not a total of three, but again, I don't have the specific dates of our actual COVID inspections in front of me at this moment, but I can get that information and get back to you if you'd like.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Knowles, so you said essentially that the package that was brought to the commissioner on the 27th, that you identified a procedural issue where you didn't have all the materials that that the commissioner wanted, and that was the rationale for not advancing that citation. Has there been any other citations like this since you've been with the Department of Labor that have been treated in this way?
Through the chair, this is my first experience with a citation proposal of this nature.
Thank you. That wasn't really answering my question. My question was, in presenting, a workplace safety citation to the commissioner, has there been any other citations that were treated in this way and therefore sort of procedurally ruled out of order while you've been working for the department? You've been there since January 2015 and in your current position since August 2018. Have you run into this situation previously, even if it was a different kind of a workplace safety specific issue, not COVID related, but you've been there for a few years now?
Through the chair, to clarify, I've been with Labor Standards and Safety for about a year and a half. I've been with the department for the 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But to be specific to your question, this is the first proposed citation package that per our policies and procedures required the commissioner's approval.
And was that based on the new standards that were a result of the change in your procedures this year? Was that the reason?
That was an application of the old per the. Are you talking about the proposed citation amount?
Yeah, the threshold at which
the threshold
at which the commissioner gets involved.
Correct. We have not had a proposed citation package that has required her approval under the new threshold.
Did you have any under the previous threshold? I'm just trying to get an answer to that one question. So.
No.
All right, so that hadn't happened previously, even under the old standard. Thank you. Representative Fields?
Thanks. Through the chair, Mr. Knowles, you said that something was missing from the package. Please tell us how many citations were there, and if something was missing on one, why did the commissioner not allow issuance of the other citations, which included both COVID and non-COVID citations?
Yes, Representative. So I'd rather speak to your second part of your question first, in that the decision that the commissioner made was after she had close consultation with law and was advised that she could approve some, none, or all of their proposal. The specifics as to why she made that decision, I cannot speak for her in detail today. but her memorandum did provide some specifics on her concerns and our process's shortcomings.
Through the chair, Mr. Knowles, so you say you can't speak to her motivations. Do you know how many times the commissioner consulted with the governor's office, either in coordination with the Department of Law or not, in making the decision not to issue a single citation?
None.
Never coordinated with the governor's office, even though she was in contact with the Department of Law. And you know that?
Yes. My answer is no to that question.
All right.
I do have more questions, but I can wait.
All right. There are other members of the committee that have questions? Representative McCarty.
So talking about the procedural, it sounds like that there's been a change in procedures since this has happened within the department. And with the, I'll start with that question. I'll have a follow-up. Mm-hmm. Okay. So is that true that the procedure has changed? And when did that procedure change take place? What date or time?
Through the chair, we revised our field operation manual, I want to say, in the latter part of January. If you need the exact date, I will have to get back to you because I don't have that in front of me at the moment. But the changes to the FOM were essentially reducing the threshold from $250,000 to $50,000 in proposed fines and changing the verbiage from consult with the commissioner to must have her approval. Internally, we've taken several actions to establish a 120-day internal timeline for earlier review of what will become the final proposal to the commissioner, mm-hmm. and that we're going to create a significant novel action template to improve our supporting document content in the proposal when it goes forward. We're going to have earlier engagement with the commissioner when a potential significant novel action proposal is being drafted within the enforcement section office. In short, we've all learned from this, and we've even asked for assistance from our federal partners to improve our process.
And I believe that we have a memo in your the materials that were provided to the committee that references a January 18th memo from the commissioner to Director Knowles on the topic. Okay, a follow-up, Representative McCarty?
Thank you. Yeah, so it sounds that you've done some serious looking at the procedural issues and how we could do it in an improved manner next time. Hopefully we won't have a next COVID-type thing next time. The question is this something that we see in the seafood industry all over Alaska? Because there's more than just one location. We see that in other places throughout the state?
Through the chair, are you speaking to issuing general duty willful citations?
The concern of that, I know of places throughout the state that there was a rise in COVID cases, even to potentially shutting down canneries. And so has there been a concern or that from this past year from your office in inspections of other places as well?
We have handled COVID complaints and referrals through a very collaborative, consultative manner and have found that to be very successful with helping employers develop and draft their COVID workplace plans. And the fact that we've had one presented proposal to the commissioner of this nature really makes me feel as if this particular case was an outlier and was unique.
Did you want to follow up on that? I'm not sure that question was answered.
I think it was in the sense of this is unique, but did you have citation type things with other places throughout the state because of COVID concerns? And I want to add another piece is did that also involve a lot of changes in the industry because of the guidelines for COVID protocol was frequently updating?
Through the chair, we've issued no citation packages, general duty for COVID.
Okay, thank you.
Does anybody want to follow up? All right, Representative Coughlin.
Thank you. Through the chair, I mentioned before that the timeline surprised me, but when I saw the combined amount for the fines, I was like, wow, those were pretty serious fines. Is there, I don't want to say precedent, but how common is that? And do you have any idea how that relates to maybe what was going on in other jurisdictions about the U.S. With similar inspections of food processing facilities? Did it seem to be in line?
Through the chair. Yes, Representative, thanks for that question. It's that particular dollar amount that we're discussing is extremely unusual. Nationally, I did a query the other day, and through December of 2020, the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which had issued 300 establishments for violations, their violations averaged approximately $13,000 in fines. And I did query the State Plan Association's database, and through February of 2021, there had been 100 citations issued resulting from COVID, of which only one was a willful. All the others were general duty. So, yes, the dollar amount in this particular proposal was very unusual.
All right. Representative Shaggy and then Rep. Nelson.
Thank you. And through the chair, can you talk a little bit about how those fines are generated, how they're determined, and how that dollar amount is set?
Yes, through the chair, I can speak to it in parts. I'm not the smartest person on it because there are a lot of variables in there. But what I can share is that there are posted within our FOM, we have the penalties supplement, and those penalties can vary in amount, and there are a lot of factors that go into determining what the penalty may be. There are several things within our policies and procedures that relate to the gravity of the violation, the size of the employer, good faith of the employer, their history and previous violations. And then again, just the nature of the violation type, specifically a willful by itself carries a maximum penalty of $134,000 and $937,000, I believe, from our latest update.
Follow up, if I may?
Follow up.
Thank you. And through the chair, so you mentioned that the average fee or fine was somewhere in the ballpark of $13,000, if I heard you correctly.
Yes.
Is Copper River Seafoods an average-sized company, or how would you compare the size of their company to others that would fail into that prior calculation?
I don't have, again, because I don't have the case in front of me with what Copper River Seafood size was, but the sizing variable deals with employers that are I believe up to 250 employers at any time during the year nationally, and then I think the next category is 251 to 500, and then possibly over 500. And then what the disparity between the average of 13,000 that I referenced before is because a serious violation, before we talked about willful a moment ago, at a maximum penalty of $134,937, a serious carries a maximum penalty of $13,494. So I believe the vast majority of COVID citations that have been issued nationally have been issued as serious, not willful, and for that $13,494 maximum.
That was my two.
All right. Did you have a third follow-up? I'm going to be a little generous here. All right. There's a lot of very good questions. So next up is Representative Nelson, and then after that, Representative Snyder.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I am wanting to know a little bit more. You say nationally, there usually are serious and not willful. So I know you don't have the file in front of you, like you said, but what, if you could speak on what kind of pushed that over? What was it specifically? Because I remember reading that they were closed prior for about 2 weeks due to cleaning of a COVID outbreak that they already had. And they are a little bit different just with seafood packing. So I'm wondering what pushed them over the edge from serious, like the nationwide, that they give out to willful. And I was hoping you could speak on that.
Through the chair. Again, I wish I had the specifics for you on that and the details, and each particular inspection that is conducted is unique in its own entity. I do know that we felt at our level within labor standards and safety that it warranted the commissioner's consideration. But again, ultimately, it's just a proposal until the citation package is actually issued. And it was a continuation of our dialogue and discussion.
Did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm all sticking right to your two questions.
All right, Rep. Snyder.
Thank you, Chair. I wish we had those documents for Mr. Knowles to be referencing with these questions, but I don't have a question because Representative Shragi beat me to the punch.
All right.
Those are mine.
I do find it a little interesting that we're invited to talk about a specific case and not to have the case files with them. I think protecting confidentiality is important, but we do need to also to understand some sort of pretty concrete factual things. We're asking some pretty straight questions here, not designed to put anybody on the spot, but really just to understand what happened here. Given that this is a pretty serious workplace issue, and my understanding is that moving from serious to willful is a knowing, there's sort of a definitional issue and relates to, knowing that you're not complying and doing it anyways. And my reading of the records was that they knew that they had COVID positive cases, that their contractor that they use at Copper River Seafoods, who happens to be the same contractor that we use here in the Capitol for our own COVID screening and vaccination, identified COVID positive cases, and that they had COVID positive cases in a workplace where they're not able to implement social, social distancing and other sort of physical barriers between employees. It's that is a big tip over into willful. They knew they had sick employees on the on the job and let them continue to work anyways. Representative Fields.
Thank you. Following up on that statement, I just want to clarify for committee members, one of the citations was for a machine that had previously ripped an employee's arm off because it didn't have proper lockdown tagout procedures. ACOSH had identified that. The employer didn't fix it, and that was one of the reasons for the willful violation. There were issues with COVID, and there were issues with these mechanical issues, which should have nothing to do with general duty or COVID issues. So I do have a question, and Mr. Knowles, I appreciate you being here and effectively claiming that, you're the reason this was done incorrectly. Honestly, I don't buy that premise. By my read of the documentation, there were four levels of approval that these citations went through: the CSHO, the lead CSHO, the ACOS chief, and the LSS director. Many of these employees have been there for years. You have not explained what was, quote, missing from the citation packet, so you're welcome to do that at any time. I guess I would ask you two questions. Lockdown tagout procedure, again, a machine that had previously torn an arm off an employee, dismembered the employee. Why did the commissioner feel it was appropriate to block a citation for such an egregious workplace safety violation?
Yes, Representative. Again, she had close consultation with law and was advised she could approve some, none, or all of the proposal.
Mr. Knowles, that did not answer the question. Why did she feel it was appropriate for a machine that had been identified as dangerous, that had torn an arm off an employee, for a citation not to proceed at all, regardless of the fine level?
Yes, Representative. representative, again, I can't speak in detail for her, but her memorandum did provide some specifics on concerns and our process shortcomings that led to her decision.
Okay, second question. As my co-chair noted, there were employees allowed on the job displaying COVID symptoms for up to a week, which contributed to this outbreak. One of the reasons that they were cited for willful violations, why did the commissioner think it was acceptable for an employer which had been warned to improve its screening procedures and to keep COVID-infected employees off the job site? Why did she think it was appropriate to entirely block a penalty after the employer willfully allowed COVID-infected individuals who were symptomatic on the job site for multiple days when they were within 6 feet of other people?
Again, Representative, she had close consultation with law, was advised she could approve some, none, or all of that. She was well within her range of legal options and her authority to make the decision that she did.
Madam Co-Chair, I've asked my two questions in closing. It is unprecedented for a commissioner to block citations in this manner. It is not supported by the statutes, and I think we will need an explanation from the commissioner and the administration about why they felt a novel interpretation of workplace safety statutes was warranted in this case.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to make sure, you know, we have on record, because there's been a lot of documents floating back and forth from different sources, from Copper River Seafoods, and they specifically addressed, you know, and permission to read, I don't know, for committees if that's allowed. But they even addressed this specifically, saying Copper River Seafoods did a poor job keeping employees safe from COVID infections this summer, asking us a question and saying the main Anchorage plant was closed for a total of 13 days to the end of July and beginning of August and the entire year of operation during the pandemic. None of the other CRS plants suffered any serious outbreaks, and operations continued without a single day interruption. Mm-hmm. So it shows that, you know, in Anchorage, you know, where it's a big hub and there's a lot of things going on, okay, yeah, there was an outbreak and they tried to take care of it, especially at the end of that month. And, you know, they started working at it, and I would like to see the documents coming out later or whoever has it to see what moved it from serious to willful. Yeah. And that's just a statement I have.
All right. Joseph, Director Knowles, you want to address the question of what was the difference between a serious and a willful citation and a violation in this issue? I mean, we've discussed it a little bit. I'm going to give you an opportunity to take a swing at it again.
Yes, Representative, are you asking for me to restate the definitions as I understand them for a willful and a serious violation, or are you asking me to understand why the commissioner made the decision that she made?
We're interested in the definitions, I think, is the issue. I think we're interested in the definitions, and if you're not comfortable providing an answer today, perhaps you can provide an answer in writing that we can distribute to the entire committee. If you submit something in writing, we'll be sure to share it with everybody. I think that we may have hit the end of the road in terms of questioning. If there are other people that want to ask additional questions of Director Knowles, I'm a little disappointed with the lack of candor about the specific citation, given that this was a pretty serious issue. And from my lens, the workers that work in seafood processing facilities, they are they're low-wage folks. They don't have health insurance. They're not organized in a union. They don't have anybody to advocate for themselves. And it's the Department of Labor's job to make sure that we have safe workplaces in the state of Alaska so that we can keep Alaska open for business. And I find it very concerning to hear that, that a citation that seemed to have risen to a pretty serious level was waived, and that what we're hearing is that it was the commissioner was well within her rights to waive it, when I would argue that this strikes me as really not meeting the objective of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to make sure that Alaska's workers are safe when they're showing up to work. We also know that, you know, that people of color and immigrants have been disproportionately represented in serious, with serious health impacts of COVID-19, and that's exacerbated if you don't have health insurance and aren't able to get the treatment you need when you get it. So for me, given that our seafood processing workforce are majority minority people of color, a lot of them are immigrants, it feels to me like we've allowed an unsafe workplace to go uncited in a pretty serious case. And I want our workplaces, I want our fishing industry to be up on step next year. Like, I want our economy to get rolling, and I want to know that our workers are going to be safe despite new variants coming into the state. What we've learned today doesn't give me a lot of confidence, unfortunately. All right. Are there any other questions?
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I totally agree. You know, we want to make sure that our seafood industry is strong and healthy for future generations. And no one could have predicted even a year ago, you know, a worldwide pandemic that is COVID. Mm-hmm. There's seafood processing plants all over the world that already adapt to COVID mitigation efforts even before COVID. You know, you could see some of the photos in there where they're wearing face shields or cover garments, and they might not be 6 feet apart, but they're working in an extreme environment where they're moving things back and forth. And I refer back to what Copper River Seafood said about some of the mitigation efforts, where they're screened for symptoms long when they arrive, so similar to what we do in this building. Mm-hmm. Making sure they wash in and out, just like anyone in the food industry has to do. They wear face shields to workers who need to be in close proximity, and high touch areas were often clean, and work breaks were staggered to facilitate social distancing. COVID is a terrible thing, do not get me wrong, but we also need to see that there's some things that we can't control, but we can have the best mitigation efforts that we possibly can and try to work on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and I will just point out that we did invite Copper River Seafoods to join us today, and they declined the invitation. We gave them an opportunity to talk about what it is that they did. We also invited the commissioner. So it's not our, it's our intention to have, a full airing of the facts. It's my understanding that that the citation documentation that we have demonstrates that there was, in fact, a disregard for COVID mitigation efforts that were designed to keep the workforce safety. All right, with that, we're going to move on to our next testifiers. The next people up we have are John Stallone and Dennis Smythe, both of whom are former ACOSH Chiefs of Enforcement. We'll start with Mr. Smythe. Mr. Smythe, are you on the line?
I'm here.
All right, thanks. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and talk about, your work with the Department of Labor in safety and kind of your experience and your qualifications to be testifying here today?
Yes, I was hired. My name's Dennis L. Smythe. I was hired in 1975, May. I gave notice to my previous employer and went to work as a safety enforcement officer on June 2nd, 1975. I was promoted to assistant chief 2 years later. And in 1979, I think it was 1979, I was promoted to chief of safety enforcement. I was promoted to chief of ACOSH after 8 years, and that included safety enforcement, health enforcement, and consultation and training. I remained in that position until I retired, until June 30th, 1997. And while I was chief of the division, basically, I was appointed acting commissioner on three different governor's transfers after the elections until the new one came in. I wanted to comment on the OSHA Act of 1970 a little bit, if it's okay.
Go ahead, Mr. Smythe.
Okay. The OSHA Act of 1970 provided for the states to adopt their own programs under the 18E group. It didn't start out as 18E. 18E was final certification. The first certification for the state of Alaska was in
You've remembered a lot of dates today already, actually. I'm pretty impressed.
I wrote them down. The initial approval was August 10th, 1973, was the initial approval for the state to have its program because they had everything in place. The final approval happened on September 28th, 1984. Okay. Someone asked me a question, I forget who it was, based about what I've heard on this case, that I find it unusual or troubling that the commissioner blocked issuance of citations or penalties, and in any case, why? I find it extremely unusual and extremely troubling, and the reason is it can endanger the program and the protection that's being offered to the employees of the state of Alaska,
All right, and what you're describing is the federal act that allowed the state of Alaska to implement its own workplace safety program rather than have workplace safety in the state of Alaska be managed by the federal government?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Thank you.
And the funding is kind of unique. The safety enforcement and the industrial hygiene enforcement are both funded 50% by federal OSHA. Safety and health consultants are funded 90% by federal OSHA.
All right. Thank you. Representative Fields?
Thanks to the chair, Mr. Smythe. Thanks for being with us. In the time that you worked with the department, did you ever see a commissioner block a citation or negate a proposed penalty in the manner that you've seen in this case? Did that ever happen?
Now, I haven't seen this case totally, but what I've been told is that it was from what I just heard from the previous director. I had never heard of that, and in fact, if I had, I'd have gone to Juneau and turned in my badge and my credentials, or gotten a better something straightened out. That's absolutely ridiculous. Politics did not run an enforcement division. Alaska statutes 1860.091 and Alaska statutes 18.60095 are extremely clear that the department must enforce the law. I don't think it's consistent with the statutes for a commissioner or any other political appointees to simply block enforcement action, period.
Thank you.
No? All right. Representative Nelson.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, Mr. Elsmite, correct? Did I get the name?
All right. Dennis Leesmite.
Perfect. Well, first off, I just want to say thank you so much for all the years that you've helped the state. Lord knows it's a thankless job. I want to know, during your time, what was the highest amount of fine you had issued on one specific citation? You know, what monetarily, what was that biggest amount?
I don't recall exactly what the biggest amount was, but I personally investigated or had one of my officers investigate fatalities that turned out to be criminal in nature. The state of Alaska, I believe, was the first state to issue criminal violations against companies.
Do you have a follow-up?
Follow-on. Through the chair. So that was only for a fatality. I'm specifically referring to a non-fatality. So specifically referring to, you know, a company that incurs a fine monetarily. I just want to see if you can remember or someone that you can reference to that had a large fine or the last thing you can remember on that.
Yeah, I don't remember what the penalty was on those criminal violations, but they were well above what you consider a willful violation. I recommended the chief of enforcement for the North Slope Public Borough Safety to arrest this guy that drove the truck that killed the people. And they didn't know how to do an investigation, a proper investigation. I had to fly up there on New Year's Day and show them how to do it. And that was Kodiak Oilfield Haulers, to be specific. The other one had to do with a company that sent an employee down a pipeline that had been purged with nitrogen so they could weld without the welds penetrating the pipe and burning on the other side. And they sent him down there, and it was absolutely not cleared. The gas was still down there. He went in there and died. And that was we calculated every way we could. That was way more than a willful. It was a criminal violation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to stick to your two rule.
All right. Thanks. Anybody else?
Actually, do you have one?
All right. Rep. McCarty.
All right. Thank you very much. Through the chair. So this process here is we're trying to get information to know what happened in this case specifically, as well as know what kind of procedures are being done and could be corrected. Right now, we haven't been given a lot of information. I'm looking at this packet really the first time, and I understand that this process here takes 180 days, of which case the information was not completely given to the commissioner until after December 27th, so it must have been given to January, of which case my understanding that they're pushing the envelope of getting the decision within the 180 days. So here we are asking for information, and I'm wondering, have you had a chance to look at the documentation regarding this case specifically to be able to make an effective decision or comments about the case? Or is this just from your background, which is valuable, but yet to specifically to this case, do you have anything specific to say from information you know about it?
I haven't seen the case. I haven't seen any documentation for it one way or the other. I only heard what the the new director, the person that's the director now, testified to.
Okay, thank you.
Are there other questions? All right, I've got a couple of questions if nobody else has any right now. In addition to blocking this enforcement action, the commissioner has directed ACOSH to screen all penalties of $50,000 or more, that all of those need to go through her office. Is this typical, or is this a kind of an appropriate way to handle penalties as they come through the department? Is it common that penalties at this level sort of get screened out by the commissioner?
No, as I tried to say before, if I had politics running my show, I would have resigned.
All right. There was one other thing you mentioned earlier when you were describing the OSHA Act of 1970, which allowed the state to create their own programs. And if I remember correctly, I remember hearing also that former Governor Jay Hammond was a real big fan of making sure that we were able to do workplace safety enforcement in the state of Alaska. And I certainly think that we know Alaska better than Washington, D.C. does. Do you think the administration's do you think concerns that workplace safety enforcement becomes political in Alaska could potentially risk our state primacy on this issue?
Absolutely. And I'd like to add, they don't have logging issues in Kansas, and they don't have seafood processing issues in Kansas, and we don't have wheat farming problems or concerns in Alaska where they do in Kansas. So it depends. That's why federal OSHA is very Region 10 is very closely looking at Alaska's program, and they fund it 50% and 90%. 50% for enforcement, 90% for consultation and training, and they can jerk that program. They don't need to give us that training, and our program would fail if we didn't have that federal funding.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Are there questions from other members of the committee?
If I could just note before we go to the next.
Yeah, go ahead, Representative Fitz.
Just to Representative Nelson's question about the scale of fines, when I worked at the Department of Labor, there was a case, a single willful violation where the fine was over $500,000. And again, I mean, this is a case that exposed almost 100 people to an infectious disease, so just in terms of recent precedent.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's helpful. It is helpful to know that there's other president, Representative Nelson.
Am I able to speak on that?
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, responding to Representative Fields, I actually just found a news article, and if I could find it real quick, of course, it's a struggle to find it, of a plant down in California, a meatpacking plant, where it was similar to Copper River Seafoods, where I believe it was $115,000. Mm-hmm. But what this was, it was similar to a COVID during the summer. And in this article, at least, it said that that was the largest meat processing plant citation and fine that in the nation at that time. So, I mean, I'd like to see that as well, and I could definitely share you this article in the future. Thank
All
you,
right.
Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, next up, we're going to go to John Stallone, who is also a former chief of enforcement at ACOSH. Mr. Stallone, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
All right. Excellent. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and tell us about your history working in a workplace safety in the state of Alaska?
Yes, my name's John Stallone, and I was chief of ACOSH enforcement I started with ACOSH in 1996, and I was a safety enforcement officer for about 3.5 years, and then I did discrimination investigations and serious accident investigations for another about a year and a half. Then I was promoted to assistant chief for about a year and a half, and then I was promoted to chief.
All right. Thank you very much. And, you know, you heard the testimony earlier, the sort of the questions and answers that went about the issue earlier. Have you... when you were the chief of enforcement with the state of Alaska, did you ever hear of a commissioner or the governor blocking enforcement of a workplace citation like this?
No, I worked with three different commissioners and never had their office ever interfere in this manner on an enforcement action. And in listening to the testimony, I'd like to make a little clarification for the other representatives there. There was two reports done. One, because you have safety and health. Health is usually administered by the industrial hygienists that work for the department, and then the safety enforcement officers, excuse me, do the safety side of it. In this particular instance, of Copper River, it was a referral, and the chief, whoever, I don't know, I don't have that information, made the decision to send two officers, one health officer, one safety officer. Mm-hmm. Now, when they conclude their inspection, it's up to them to come back and prepare their report, and it's done on obviously on a computer, but it's done on a federal format because this information is shared throughout the United States with all the other states and other federal and the entire federal agency of occupational safety and health. And then, so, you know, my confusing part of this was Evidently, Akash did not send the commissioner's office the safety report. They sent to the commissioner only the health report, and then later sent the safety report. But, you know, those citations, I don't know if the committee understands this or not, but the commissioner could have, like law told her to do, she could eliminate, reduce, or upheld all of those citations. And I have a real problem in my, you know, in the fact that she just waited for the statute of limitations to run its course and threw out two complete reports. That sets a real dangerous precedent for the rest of the state. How about other employers? Are they going to bring this up at a future date and go, well, why don't you just wait for the statute of limitations to run out like you did for Copper River? This is unprecedented. I've never had, I know one of the questions has been, what's the most dollar amount? Actually, the biggest one, if Dennis is still listening, he was chief at the time, was one of the largest ones ever written by Akash, was close to $1 million, and it was against Department of Corrections. Now, instead of collecting the money, they allowed the Department of Corrections to go and correct everything that was cited. I know I was in the field at the time, and I had to go and verify in various communities in the state of Alaska that these items had been actually abated or fixed. And when I was chief, one of the I was assistant chief at the time. A company called Whitewater Engineering was cited again for a fatality, and it was they were also charged with criminally negligent homicide. And when something like this happens, the chief always, when it's something that serious, always consults with the AG's office, the Attorney General's office. There's actually one or more assistant AGs that are assigned to that section to handle potential legal questions coming up. But I would consult with them, but as a courtesy, I told the director at the time that, you know, we have done this to this company and we've cited them, but I never got permission from anyone to issue citations. And I've issued several willfuls, and I signed them and sent them out, and we went through, because there's a real legal process through this whole matter. You have an informal conference with the chief. They don't like the outcome on that. They move on to the OSH review board, which is a 3-member panel appointed by the governor and an administrative law judge. If you don't like the outcome from that, you can go to Superior Court. So there is a system in here. It's not just the chief's, say so and that's it. It's over. It's not over. There's quite a legal process involved in this.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions? Oh, is that Representative Snyder? No?
Mm-hmm. All right. You have a question.
You do? All right, Rep. McCarty.
All right. Mr. Stallone, through the chair, that two questions. One is, do we know that the commissioner did not respond within the statute of limitations of the 180 days, or did respond in that?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not privy to that kind of information, but I mean, that's what I was told by people that work there, that the statute of limitations has run out, and it's pretty specific in the law that if you allow if you do not issue a citation within 6 months, within 6 months from the start of the inspection, then it's null and void, and that's what happened. They waited over 180 days, and then the citations are absolutely dropped because of statute of limitations. Well, they were never issued. If they had been issued, then they could have gone through the legal process and defended their position the way it was set up to do through the OSH Review Commission and, if need be, Superior Court, like Whitewater did. Whitewater went through the OSH Review, and then they ended up in Superior Court because it was criminal charges.
Okay.
Follow-up?
Yeah, a follow-up. And I heard you say that, you explained the statute of limitations, but I also heard you say that you're not sure if it did or did not happen to that. And the question I have in this follow-up is, like, do you know what the question that the commissioner asked of the Attorney General's Office, Department of Law, regarding this, what the commissioner was concerned about, and what advice she was seeking?
No, I'm not privy to that, but just from what Director Knowles said was that law told her she could leave it stand, she could reduce it, or she could dismiss it. She would have the authority to dismiss it, but if she did, if my understanding was she let the statute of limitations take over, but if she dismissed it in writing, then, you know, my question would be why? I mean, the COVID general duty is, I understand there's some, it's kind of new ground. Nobody, you know, we've never had that before in that particular pandemic kind of situation. But the other citations, like the one for the lockout tagout, where on the machine that ripped the man's arm off of his body, that was a repeat. You realize that right now they don't even have to fix that. Now, hopefully they will, but they should have fixed it after the first accident, and they didn't. They didn't train the people correctly, and it's just, if they don't do it correctly, it's just a matter of time before somebody else loses their arm in that conveyor belt.
All right. Thank you. Representative Schrage?
Yeah, thank you, and through the chair. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, the objective of the department here is to protect workers, and that's done through identifying these violations and taking enforcement action. And when there's an absence of corrective measures, enforcing penalties. And if that's the objective of the department, then why would the commissioner not let the fines go through, knowing that maybe there's an issue with some noticing or some technical paperwork issues in levying those fines or penalties? But why not allow the company to go through the legal process that they have to argue their case and argue for either a reduction or a dismissal of those charges? Wouldn't it be the commissioner's objective to enforce those penalties and take that enforcement action in order to protect workers? I mean, in this case, we have no enforcement and no penalty, no repercussions, and no reason for the company to take those corrective actions and protect workers. So I'd just like you to opine on that for a moment, if you could.
To answer your question, yes, absolutely. It's the commissioner's responsibility. In fact, in statute, the commissioner can be held personally liable. I don't know if she's aware of that or not, but she better read the statutes, because she can be held personally liable if she doesn't do what the law requires her to do.
Thank you. I just note that this, in my view, from my lens, sets a dangerous precedent that we can allow a simple paperwork error or small noticing issue to provide grounds for a complete dismissal of a very serious enforcement action for very serious violations that very seriously harmed many workers. So very concerned by all the details that have come out through this process.
Do you have a question, Representative Kaufman?
Thank you. Through the chair, I've got a document here. I found it in my package, and stuff has been coming in fast from all different directions, I guess, on this, but has anybody else seen this? It's a, like a, looks like a Excel. It's a register of non-conformance completion report. So it says ACOSH non-conformance completion report. And then it's got a whole bunch of action items that were finished 11/20, 10/28, 10/28, 11/20. And so I just wanted to mention that because it sounded like I was hearing that things hadn't been corrected, that they were being allowed to go uncorrected. And I'd seen that, and I didn't know if anybody else had. There's a lot of things here listed, and all looks like they were completed in somebody's opinion. I don't know who. I don't know where this document came from.
Could I comment on that?
Sure.
Go ahead. The chair will go ahead. The chair says sure.
Through the chair, sure.
Go ahead.
When you've done a report like that, some of the items get abated. That's the word that they use. They don't use the word fixed. They use the word abated. Sometimes an employer will abate the situation while the officer is still there, or they'll provide them with documentation that it has been abated at a later time, maybe a week later, you know, a couple weeks later. So, but that doesn't negate the fact that you had a violation at the time of inspection. I'm glad that they did that. I mean, hopefully they will, whether they get cited or not, they'll correct all the things that were wrong. But that doesn't negate the fact that they broke the law.
And perhaps Representative Kaufman will make sure that the chairs get that, and we can share that with other members of the committee as well.
Sure.
If we're going to reference it in the official record. Yep. Representative Fields.
Thanks. And I guess before getting to the question, I did want to state it's certainly not my intent to essentially try this employer, which is located in my district. I don't think a committee hearing is the appropriate venue for that. Unfortunately, the commissioner's decision, as Representative Shiragi noted, effectively denied them due process to address these things in the proper manner. Mr. Stallone, Alaska statutes 1860.091 and 1860.095 seem pretty clear that the department must enforce the law. And do you agree with Mr. Smythe that the commissioner really doesn't have the authority to ignore the law's requirements in a case like this?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the statute is very clear. And like I said, you know, Dennis and I agree with Dennis. I haven't seen him in a while. But commissioners are not supposed to go in and do things of this nature and negate the statute. I mean, they're supposed to be enforcing it along with the chief and the director. But I've just never had a commissioner come in and take over like this, and then have, I guess now the new criteria is if it's over $50,000, it needs the commissioner's approval, which has never happened before. Like I stated before, it just never has. We would, as a courtesy, discuss it with the director. I certainly wouldn't call the commissioner on a citation over $50,000 or over $100,000. At that level, I might discuss it with the director that we were going ahead and I'd already signed the citations. Just want to give you a heads up. And citations would have been mailed out.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Stallone, for being here. And to the chair, it doesn't look like Mr. Knowles is with us. He did mention that the commissioner had established a policy of running penalties in excess of $250,000 through the commissioner. I think we might want to ask, when was that policy put in place? Of course, as Mr. Stallone mentioned, now we have a new threshold of $50,000, but the bottom line is, whatever the threshold, this level of politicization of enforcement seems to be unprecedented in state history. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I want to thank everybody for who's joining us today, and everybody for the having Director Knowles online and then former directors, Mr. Smythe and Mr. Stallone, it was great to have your stories with the history of workplace safety in Alaska and also kind of the rigorous process that's in place and how traditionally this has been a pretty apolitical process. It was very interesting for me. I don't have a background in workplace safety, and so I learned a lot today, and I really enjoyed it. I also really enjoyed the tone of the discussion today, and I think sometimes, you know, in the legislature we discuss difficult things, but being able to do it respectfully and professionally is really nice, and I appreciate everybody's, you know, professionalism in discussing what could be, you know, kind of a hot topic. And with that, we're going to sort of close out this section of the hearing because we have another, we have a bill that we want to hear. We want to hear SB 24. And we're going to take a brief at ease while we let Senator Wilson make his way back to the building. And we've got some invited testifiers as well to comment on the bill. We're going to take a brief at ease. Also available for questions, we have Sharon Walsh, who's the Deputy Director with the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing, and Lori Wolf, CEO of the 4-Acre Group, and Steve Mahoney, who's an established nonprofit and corporate attorney, are also available. All right, Senator Wilson, would you like to go ahead and introduce yourself and the bill and introduce your staff as well?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Fields, Chair Sponholz, and the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, I am Senator David Wilson, Senator for District G, and with me is my trustee legislative staff, Ms. Jasmine Martin. Senate Bill 24 would authorize the virtual shareholders nonprofit member meetings to be able to be virtual. These organizations have had this ability in the past year due to the emergency declaration, but we all know that has expired. And this past year, we've all attended our fair meetings virtually, and we've all watched life just zoom on by. But this has caused some hardship going through this, but also through the emergency declaration. This has also inspired innovation. It's imperative that we use this innovation to help improve our laws for the future. This bill gives nonprofits, corporations, the tools to capitalize on their virtual success and to meet virtual in the future. And just to note, this is not a requirement. This would only happen if the organizations would allow it inside their bylaws. I just want to say thank you for your consideration, and I'll turn it over to my trustee staff, Ms. Martin, who will can help address the mechanics of the bill and do a sectional if that's the committee of the chair.
Go ahead.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, and I can cover a sectional.
Go ahead.
And so essentially this bill affects three different parts of law. It's going to affect the Alaska Corporation Code, the Business and Industrial Development Code, and the Alaska Nonprofit Corporation Act. And I'll try to kind of differentiate what I'm going through so you can see, you know, why we're kind of saying the same thing over and over again. But essentially, it just inserts remote communication a lot into statute. And so I'm just going to say the statute, and I'm going to say it inserts remote communication in certain parts. So Section 1 is the Alaska Corporation Code. Section 1 relates to organizational meetings of Alaska corporations and allows these to be held via remote communication or via a hybrid of remote communication and in-person, and modifies the notice requirements to reflect this change. Section 2 relates to bylaws of corporations and inserts remote communication. Section 3 relates to meetings of shareholders. It allows meetings of shareholders to be held via remote communication. Section 4 relates to the meetings of shareholders and allows the board of a corporation to set a time for meetings if the time is not set by bylaws. Section 5 relates to notice of shareholder meetings. It directs corporations to include the manner and definition of present in meeting notices. Section 6 relates to the list of shareholders entitled to vote at a meeting or on adjournment, and allows this list to be available electronically. Section 7 relates to quorum in meetings. It inserts remote communication. Section 8 relates to voting by proxy. It inserts remote communication. Section 9 relates to voting by shares. Same things, inserts by remote communication. Section 10, again, relates to voting shares, and inserts by remote communication. Section 11 relates again to voting shares and inserts by remote communication. Section 12 relates to voting shares and adds conforming language pertaining to voting by proxy via remote communication. Section 13 adds a new section that relates to voting shares. It allows shareholders and shareholder proxies to participate in meetings via remote communication. Section 14 relates to meetings of executive and other board committees and allows these meetings to be held by remote communication. Section 15 relates to corporations organized under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And actually, Section 15, 16, and 17 all relate to these organizations and allows them to vote on amendments to their articles of incorporation via remote communication. Section 18 adds a new definition for remote communication. And then, so Section 19, we have two sections, Section 19 and 20, that relate to the organizations organized under the Alaska Business and Industrial Development Corporations Act. And so Section 19 inserts remote communication in AS 10-10-100. And then Section 20 relates to executing a proxy by electronic transmission. And then, so Section 21, we transition into the Alaska Nonprofit Corporations Act. Section 21 relates to nonprofit meeting notices, establishes that meeting notices should include manner by which the meeting will be held. Section 22 relates to voting by proxy, allows a member to vote by remote communication or by proxy executed by electronic transmission. Section 23 relates to establishing a quorum. It allows members present through remote communication to be counted towards a quorum. Section 24 adds a new section to AS 10-20-071. It relates to establishing a proxy, defines how a proxy could be established by remote communication. Section 25 relates again to establishing a proxy and it inserts remote communication. Section 26 relates to regular and special meetings of a board of directors, allows meeting to be held in person by remote communication or a hybrid of both. Section 27 relates to organizational meetings. It allows organizational meetings to be held via remote communication. Section 28 again defines remote communication. And then Section 29, Section 30, Section 31 apply to the whole bill. So Section 29 adds a saving clause for the retroactivity clause in Section 30. Section 30 makes this bill retroactive to March 11th, 2020. That means that organizations that have already adopted these changes in their bylaws under the disaster declaration don't have to go readopt those bylaws. And then Section 31 adds an immediate effective date.
All right, thank you very much. I have a question about the definition of remote communication in 10-06-990. Can you read that into the record for folks?
Yep. Remote communication means communication by means of electronic communication, conference telephone, video conference, the internet, electronic communication, or other means by which a person not physically present in the same location may communicate with each other on a substantially simultaneous basis. And for the record, Jasmine Martin again.
All right. Thank you very much. That's very helpful. All right. Are there questions for the bill's sponsor or Ms. Martin? Representative Shaggy.
Yeah, and I thank you through the chair. I may have an incorrect understanding, but I was informed a while back that prior to the COVID declaration, the emergency declaration, electronic meeting was actually a possibility, and that under the lapse of the declaration that there was some error to where it was no longer allowed. Am I mistaken in that? Could you clarify that for me?
That is, in fact, true as it relates to nonprofit corporations. I'm less familiar with corporate law. You want to address the question?
I think Representative Sponholz addressed it fairly well. It was permissible for nonprofits mostly. This makes it a little bit clearer, but it was not permitted for for-profit corporations.
Perfect. Thank you.
I personally have both staffed and been on the chair of many board meetings that have taken place via GoToMeeting, Zoom, and other forms online for many years. It's one of the things that nonprofits have done for a long time in order to manage costs because they have smaller budgets than do for-profit corporations. So.
Thank you.
Especially across Alaska, yeah. All right. Fantastic. Thank you. Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor? All right, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, is there any concern about making about being able to verify that the people with, like, say, signature or voting authority are actually those that are present when we're in a room together? It's easy to identify who's who. Is there any challenge there that is created by this?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, we have not heard any of those type of complaints. I think in the bill packet, we've had a lot of support from various Nader shareholders, corporations, other nonprofit entities, and other corporations in the telecom associations. It's up to their bylaws of how they authenticate their members and how proxies are going to be done. We leave that up into the individual organizations to determine that. We do not want to get into the nitty-gritty of those. Our office has been contacted for those type of amendments, but we did not want to write bylaws of corporations that would be universal for all entities, to allow those entities to have the flexibility to be nimble and to be able to write their own bylaws.
Yeah, and just for clarification, the bylaws are sort of like a constitution for a corporation. So every organization has their own bylaws, and they are they're the document that everybody in the organization has to agree upon in terms of their set of rules. So to the extent that bylaws allow for something to take place and that organization agrees on what the rules are for verification, then this law would allow that to continue. And I think we have Steve Mahoney, who's an attorney on retainer, I believe, of the Four Acre Group, will also describe some of the reason that we need to have this bill in order to make sure that it's absolutely clear that organizations have the authority to do this. There was some ambiguity created by the passage of SB 241, at least in the nonprofit sector. All right. Other questions?
Sorry.
Looks like Representative McCarty just got back in from the rain.
It's snowing.
Oh, wow. We heard it might snow, and apparently it is. Well, that's exciting. All right. All right. No additional questions for the bill sponsor. Thank you very much for the introduction. I think next up we're going to go to Lori Wolf, CEO of the 4-Acre Group. Ms. Wolf, are you online?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Can hear you just fine. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Sponholz and Representative Fields. For the record, my name is Lori Wolf. I'm the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, which serves as a state nonprofit association for Alaska and a nonprofit capacity builder organization. As the voice of the nonprofit sector, I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee on Senate Bill 24 regarding virtual meetings for corporations. For the past 20 years, 4-Acre has been advising nonprofits on how to hold their meetings based on Alaska law and the bylaws of each organization. We're interested in Senate Bill 24 because it impacts all 6,000 nonprofits operating in the state. As you all likely know and have heard, each nonprofit organization is required to have both articles of incorporation and bylaws filed with the state. Both are legally binding documents, and neither can supersede state or federal law. In fact, organizational bylaws play an important function in this debate and the way you decide to draft this law. For those of you who might be new to nonprofit bylaws, this is a set of rules established by the board of directors. Bylaws are an internal document that dictate the rules for decision-making by the corporation. They're vetted by the Internal Revenue Service when granting nonprofit exempt status. In the meeting section of bylaws, you'll find the rules for establishing a meeting, the number of directors or members needed to constitute a quorum, the definition and use of a proxy to vote, the intent to use Robert's Rules of Order or not to conduct business, and for some, even the framework for decision-making using either majority rules or consensus. To this end, bylaws are the rules that each organization crafts and adjusts as the needs of the institution demand. Each set of bylaws also dictate how they can be amended or changed. Since no two organizations are identical, it is imperative that the bylaws for each allow for them to match the life cycle, complexity, geography, and access to technology of the institution and the people involved. All of this explanation of bylaws is to say that this is where the details live on how to organize a meeting, conduct it, and make decisions. And what follows for that to be true is that is a state law that is simple, broad, and flexible enough for every corporation to live by. The reality is that Alaska has been law has been broad enough to allow board meetings to be held through distance technology for well over three decades. We have shared that understanding with organizations for years, and we have provided that explanation to you to lay the groundwork for this testimony. So how did we get here today? In the legislature's understandable rush last year to enact legislation while facing the first wave of the global pandemic, a measure was passed authorizing virtual meetings for corporate boards. This was done as part of the state's disaster declaration in the belief that the state law was prohibiting distance delivery meetings. We viewed this as a solution in search of a problem. Alaska nonprofits could already hold meetings via distance delivery if their bylaws allowed for it. In fact, most, including Forager, had been doing this for decades via teleconference and more recently through web-based platforms like Zoom, WebEx, and Teams. In the past law, and the one in the disaster declaration, and we hope in any new proposal, two ingredients were and need to be in place. First, a quorum of board members, as defined by each group's bylaws, must be gathered to make lawful decisions. And second, all persons participating can hear and speak to each other at the same time in real time. Only when these two factors are in place can we be certain that the board is exercising its duty of care by acting with one voice. This is ensured when the opportunity exists to fully discuss, refine, and defend ideas before making a decision. There are certainly other characteristics of a high-performing meeting, but for the purpose of this conversation, we are simply focused on ensuring that both of these items, quorum and simultaneous communication, be included in any forthcoming proposals. We applaud Senator Wilson's effort to codify an allowance for virtual meetings. However, this law does not need to describe every permutation of governance, but needs to allow groups to be consistent with their bylaws. We urge you to act broadly, to defer to the bylaws of each organization as much as possible, and to create a flexible framework for all Alaska's corporations, as has been the case for many decades. Respectfully, we see an easy, simple, and complete solution by simply adding a Section 8 to AS 1020-290, which states that, quote, in person, end quote, means physical presence or where a person may participate by means of a conference telephone or similar communications equipment by means of which all persons participating in the meeting can hear each other at the same time. Perhaps that the circumstance of COVID caused us to be here tonight, but the reality is we have always had and will continue to need a way to conduct our business from a distance. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My staff and I are happy to help and by answering questions, and I will stay on the line. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Wolf? All right, if you could send in your description of what needs to be included in the bill so that we can make sure that the bill's sponsor and we are clear that that the language that we're advancing meets the definition. I think actually that they do synchronize pretty nicely. The definition as was read by Ms. Martin earlier, I think dovetails nicely with what you were describing. They say the same thing, but we'll just want to make sure with our legal team that they do.
Through the chair, that might be true, although the current reading that we heard was something called something like substantially simultaneous, and that is not what we are recommending.
And do you want to describe the concern about the definition of substantially simultaneous versus simultaneous?
We feel like that's open to confusion. Through the chair, sorry. We feel like that's open to confusion. And we do, over the last 20 years, we have had many questions about whether, for example, this includes email voting, which the previous law was very clear that email voting was not simultaneous communication and was not a place where you could establish a quorum, and that you could take an advisory vote that had unanimous consent, but then you would still have to ratify it in a meeting where there was simultaneous communication, the opportunity to vet, defend, update a decision, et cetera. So for it could be an opportunity for confusion where it, that might not be necessary.
All right, thank you. And I think that that if everybody understands that an email communication, because it's not wholly simultaneous, not everybody is hearing the same thing at the same time, and you're not able to participate in sort of an iterative communication, it can lead sometimes to miscommunications. And also, if somebody is not available to communicate in a timely manner, their voice may not be included. The information that they have could not necessarily be considered in the final decision making. And so I think it's important what you're saying is that it be fully simultaneous. So we will we'll dig into that a little bit more, Ms. Wolf. Thank you.
Through the chair, just say you also can't establish a quorum over email.
Yeah.
You can't call a meeting to order, and you cannot establish a quorum.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions about this? This is a little bit of a nuanced discussion here. So. All right, Representative Kaufman.
Just a quick, thank you. Just a quick comment. I'm thinking of a frozen Zoom meeting when we're talking about simultaneous.
funny. We had a little freezing earlier in our labor and commerce, our labor finance subcommittee earlier, Ms. Wolf, on Teams, and it was that was a specific reference to a shared experience earlier today. All right. Go ahead, Ms. Wolf.
I just wanted to say that Steve Mahoney is on the line. If you have legal considerations or questions, we often defer to him when we have more complex questions from our nonprofits. So,
all right, Mr. Mahoney, you on the line?
Chairman Sponholz, thank you. I don't know that I have. Additional testimony. I've been practicing law in Alaska for 40 years. The last 20, almost half of my practice is nonprofit. I represent more than a few boards throughout the state, as well as provide and seek counsel to a number of organizations that are C6, C4s, which are not charitable but otherwise nonprofits. I applaud Senator Wilson and his staff for this drafting and this bill. It's important for nonprofits because one of the pre-considerations of any legislation is that if there is a change, as there was in SB 241, there's a presumption that the prior law did not allow what was amended in the new law. If that's the case, we do need a little correction here, and what we're really looking at is a clarification rather than a change, and the allowance for having meetings that are not physically present to count a quorum or physically present to count a vote is important. And again, I applaud the drafting that's proposed. We look to a more simplified process if we could, or change. The least change is usually the best change if it gets us to the same place. And that's why Ms. Wolf's suggestion with regard to adding a definition for in-person to subsection 290 we believe would get us to the same place as the changes proposed in sections 21, 22, and 23, and we hope that would be considered when the bill is finally passed out. The important part here is that, as you were saying, Representative Sponholz, Madam Chair, being able to speak and hear in a meeting so that there is a discussion, and that's the important part, that board members and members have the right to discuss issues before they're decided upon, is enormously important. It's the only way we can properly act. And the proposals made allow for that to occur and clarify what some people could be confused about, even though for, as Ms. Wolf suggested, decades, we have practiced remote communications, properly speaking and hearing together to make decisions in boards. Thank you.
Thank you. And your full name for the record? Mr. Mahoney? I don't think you introduced yourself at the very beginning. I think I just referenced you, so you might need to say your full name for the record.
I'm sorry, Francis Mahoney.
All right, thank you. He also goes by Steve. Any other questions for Mr. Mahoney? All right, thank you. there anything else that Senator and Ms. Martin would like to add for the record?
No, Madam Chair. Just thank you for the opportunity to be before you today to present this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. It was great to have you here today. Thank you for staying late. With these are House hours, not Senate hours for sure. thank you for having a little patience with us. We're a little behind schedule in the House, and we have to work some extra hours to get caught up. So our intent is to bring up this bill again on Friday for public testimony and then move it from committee at our next meeting on Friday. So any amendments should be delivered to the co-chairs no later than this Friday, March 12th at 10 a.m. For the record. And our final order of business is to forward the appointees that we heard at a last meeting to a joint session for our consideration. I'm going to ask you to stay for a second after we gavel out to sign the paperwork, and that members attending remotely join us in Barnes 124 after we adjourn to sign the paperwork. The House Labor and Committee, Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees as described below and recommends that the names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Nicholas Miller, Marijuana Control Board, Thomas Trasvig, Occupational Safety and Health Review Board, Enloe Walker, State Board of Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy, Elizabeth Johnston, State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers and Land Surveyors, James Rhodes, Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. This does not reflect an intent by any members to vote for or against any of these individuals in a further session for the purposes of confirmation. So that wraps up our business this evening. Our next meeting is Friday, March 12th at 3:15. We'll consider several of the governor's appointees as well as SB 24, again, and HB 36 relating to motor vehicle dealers, which we heard last week, and HB 99 relating to physical and occupational therapy, also which we heard last week. Those are both representative claimants' bills. A friendly reminder that any amendments for HB 36 or HB 99 should be turned into the co-chairs 24 hours before our next meeting, so that's 3:15 p.m. on Thursday at the latest. We're pushing the deadline for amendments on SB 24 to Friday at 10 a.m. to allow members and legal drafters a little more time since we heard the bill today, but it is time-sensitive bill because of the expiration of the disaster declaration, so we want to move with a little urgency, so we appreciate everybody's flexibility as we move this bill quickly. So this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 7:39 p.m. Thanks.